Hello, everybody, and welcome to Grim Scenarios. I'm your host, Milk, along with your other host, Emma. And oh boy, Emma, here we go. This is going to be interesting.
We are starting Project Townsfolk Tearing. It's going to be a lot to go through. Here's the format we settled on for doing the Townsfolk. We're going to start by tearing all 13 Trouble Brewing Townsfolk in this episode. Then the next episode we'll do all 13 Sex and Violets Townsfolk. And the one after that we'll do all 13 BMR Townsfolk. And that'll do 39 of, I think it's the 68 Townsfolk.
Yep. And then we'll have the experimentals left to figure out.
Yes, which we have not yet figured out, but this is the plan.
And I think in some ways this is helpful because I do think if we go through the base three first, we'll have some basic forms of townsfolk that we will have talked about, things like demon banes, things like start knowings. So we'll have a nice baseline by which to compare the experimentals once we get to them.
Exactly. So without further ado, and without a lot of chicanery, because 13 townsfolk, that's a lot, and we want to keep this to around an hour, we'll just jump straight into the Trouble Brewing Townsfolk. The first one off the block is, of course, the Washerwoman. We're doing these in script order, so the order they're laid out on your script sheets for Trouble Brewing. The Washerwoman's ability is you start knowing that one of two players is a particular townsfolk.
An exceptionally powerful ability taken in a vacuum, right? You learn two people. One of them is a particular townsfolk. If you go to your two people and say, hey, are you this townsfolk? And one of them says yes, in a vacuum, at least, that's pretty strong.
Yeah, confirmation is one of the most powerful things the good team gets, because it changes the good team from having X number of players who don't know anyone else on their team to X number of players to one player who knows someone else on their team, which is a dramatic shift in the power level, of the baseline power level. This seems very simple, but it's a quite strong ability, and I want to emphasize that about confirmation characters, is these are very strong abilities. Milk, what are the sort of strategic things that the Washerwoman has to consider, in your view, to help us sort of think about how we rank it?
Yeah, I think maybe we can just start talking about it on Trouble Brewing, right? So Trouble Brewing has a couple of ways that the Washerwoman's information can get disrupted. But strategically speaking, let's just think about the base case of you're a Washerwoman that's gotten true information on one of two people. There's a couple of things to think about strategically. The first is your role has done its thing, and so might be considered more willing to die, or specifically, and we're going to talk about this one a lot, more willing to be killed by the evil team in the night in place of the person you're confirming. So, for example, if you're a Washerwoman confirming an empath, it might be better for town if you get killed instead of your person that you're confirming, in which case you might want to do some sort of a role swap, right? That's a possibility. You might not want to be super loud and open about what role you're confirming, because you don't necessarily want people to be able to sort of figure out, oh, well, the empath must be there because the Washerwoman is saying they confirmed an empath and they're sort of voting together with this person and talking to them a lot. There are some strategic things around that. And then there's a little bit of strategy involved in how do you make sure that now, not in the case where we definitely know our information is true, where we have the drunk and the poisoner and the spy on the script, how do you make sure you're getting the best possible confirmation with the other player? And that might be going to them and doing a, hey, I'll tell you, I'm the Washerwoman, I saw you, I'll tell you three roles, or hey, I'm a top four, I saw you, give me three roles you might be. You know, there's a number of different ways that people kind of do that interaction.
Yeah. Sometimes people will talk about, you know, how, like, the confirmation went down and whether how credible it is. I think this can be an overwrought discussion a lot of the time from your perspective as the Washerwoman. This is more theater you do with the player you're confirming for other players' benefit.
You're going to probably
get a
social
I think there's some things
read,
you want
right.
to think about there. You don't want to just say, come up to players and say, hey, I'm confirming you as X role. You are that role, right? Because then if your information is wrong, you've told the demon which of the three bluffs you saw them as.
Yeah, and right? you might have a social read from your conversation. You know, you kind of are going to interact with this player maybe a little bit more than you might be interacting with other players. So, you know, there might be some opportunities through there for you to kind of validate for yourself. But you're not trying to validate for yourself. You're trying to validate for everyone else.
Yeah, I think, like, a lot of the washerwoman's job is sort of to, as I think you touched on a little bit, is to sort of protect their confirmation. And that can be done in a lot of different ways, and I think that gives the washerwoman a lot of its depth. You can do that by refusing to tell people who you're confirming until it becomes important. I frequently use this strategy when I'm playing confirmation roles like the washerwoman or other things that are confirming one player, is I just try to keep quiet who I'm confirming so the demon doesn't know who I'm confirming and I can sort of read socials off who's willing to vote on my confirmation. And then if it becomes relevant, i.e. if my confirmation is getting pressure on them in town, I might say something. or like, you know, if it's getting towards the end game. Another thing I think you can do, you should have thought about as a washerwoman is being willing to sacrifice yourself to protect the player you're confirming. A lot of the time, the player who's being confirmed is more reliably trustable than the player who's doing the confirmation, because most scripts with these information confirmation rules will have some way for evil to fake having that information. Frequently, Trouble Brewing's obvious pair is the spy.
Right.
So, like, if people are worried about the confirmation including two evils, it frequently makes more sense to cut off the head of the confirmation than cut off the confirmed player in the pair. Like, if you think of one of them as the head, the other is the body, the confirmer, the washerwoman, is the head, the player being confirmed is the body, it's frequently more useful to town to cut off the head, and you should be sort of... And a lot of times I think players sometimes aren't willing enough to do that. Not so much with the washerwoman, but particularly with the with its friend we're going to talk about very shortly, the librarian. You should sacrifice yourself for the player you're confirming most of the time. That also sets up adding to your confirmation chain through a undertaker, which can be makes it even more powerful.
As a bluff for the evil team, washerwoman is fantastic, but it can be hard to pull off if you're going outside of your evil team. You're gonna need either a real hard read on somebody, or you're gonna need to have a spy. Most people are going to be more suspicious of a washerwoman confirmation that comes after the first day of the game as well. There's a sort of social expectation that the washerwoman's going to go find their person pretty quickly.
Yeah. I think if you can pull off the confirmation of a good player as an evil player bluffing washerwoman, it's frequently very powerful. But again, because sort of washerwomen are less valuable than their protect, you want to be careful about how you manage that. But say, like, you go and try to pull one of the washerwoman tricks on people, like, hey, tell me three roles you might be, I'll tell you if that's the one I saw. Like, you can get a read that someone gives you three fake roles and then pick a fourth role that, at that point, you have the three roles that you know they aren't because of the way they said it, the three roles that you got, that your evil team got as bluffs. Like, you have a decent shot of just, like, hitting the role they actually are.
And if
you just pick randomly at that point.
And if you think that their role is in there, you might actually get a 1 in 3. And if you get a vocal cue or you hear something, you might actually just catch their role, which is really, really strong for you individually. And that's good on Trouble Brewing. If you're a demon, it can be quite strong. If you're a minion on Trouble Brewing, it's good because later in the game, you're going to want to catch a star pass potentially if they've kind of gotten past the point where they want to kill the washerwoman. One other thing about bluffing. I don't know that there's a consistent. I don't know if there's a consistent answer to which part of the washerwoman confirmation bluff between two evil players town is going to think is the demon more often. But if you are an evil team using a washerwoman confirmation to confirm a player, it's usually the confirmed player that tends to be more suspicious. because, you know, you would normally have a minion trying to make a demon look good. So it's okay to mix that up. It's okay for the demon to confirm a minion. Washerwomen are high priority to nominate virgins as well, so that can be a little bit tricky in addition. But there's ways to navigate a virgin confirmation, which we'll talk about when we get to virgin.
Yeah. I think Washerwomen, from just what we've been discussing, has a lot of depth to its strategy. I think I want to tentatively slot it in A tier.
I think it's A tier quite correctly, yeah.
As I mentioned, Washerwomen sort of comes with a character that does almost exactly the same stuff, except it's, for outsiders, this is the librarian. You start knowing that one of two players is a particular outsider, or that zero are in play in setups without outsiders. The librarian is very similar to the washerwoman. In principle, almost everything we said about the washerwoman applies to the librarian. The sort of one difference there is the librarian has to deal with the fact that they might not get a confirmation, and that's not because of zero R in play. Like, that's sort of a sort of side wonkiness just to make it work on base zero outsider scripts,
yep.
The setups. That's because, of course, the function of the drunk on Trouble Brewing, and other outsiders on other scripts such as Mutant, Damsel, Politician, that are incentivized to not accept a confirmation. Or characters that don't know they're being confirmed. Like, that does, I think, make Librarian a little bit more... It just adds another layer of depth compared to the Washerwoman.
I think there's another part of Librarian that I find very interesting strategically, which is that Librarian adds a piece to the outsider count puzzle, especially in base 3 games, and as players are learning how to play Blood on the Clock Tower, there's a good period of time, and even like now, you know, having played so many games, Emma and I, you know, we still use outsider count as a sort of litmus test or as a sort of useful piece of information. And since Librarian does contribute to having ways to confirm parts of your outsider count, I do think that adds another strategic layer to it where you can kind of use it to do broader solving. Whereas, you know, a washerwoman's confirming a townsfolk, and that's great, but often outsider count is more crucial to the sort of overall solve just in terms of numbers.
Mm-hmm.
The same weaknesses and vulnerabilities that we mentioned about Poisoner Spy, Drunk, those all apply to Librarian. Drunk, there's a little like...
Yeah, Drunk is... Between Drunk and
Librarian,
is,
you know.
Yeah, the interaction between Washerwoman and Drunk is pretty limited to, I think, the so-called spy trick you can do where you show the spy as the role the drunk thinks they are to the washerwoman as well as yep. the drunk to let the washerwoman confirm drunk information. Like, that's pretty much the limit of the washerwoman-drunk interaction mechanically other than just general bad information. But the drunk can sort of just take away the librarian's confirmation because the librarian learns that one of two players is the drunk, but the librarian might also be the drunk, and they've learned two evil players or two good players who are sober. Like, the drunk adds a little bit more like uncertainty to the librarian than it does to the washerwoman.
Yeah. But I do think that's interesting. I don't think, like, I think that's an interesting, like, element of strategy in thinking about using the character. So I do think that outsider count piece just makes librarian, I mean, just it certainly makes librarian at least as interesting, if not more interesting strategically than the washerwoman.
I think I want to put them in the same tier, but if I was going to split them, I would put librarian higher.
Yeah, yeah. I'm agreeing with you. Librarian goes in A tier. It was just kind of an interesting side note.
Yeah, especially if it's base zero outsiders, so 7, 10, or 13 players, the librarian gets exponentially more powerful because the librarian either learns that there's no baron in play or that they are the drunk if they learn a zero.
And that's all powerful information.
That's all incredibly powerful information. They can also technically be poisoned on 10 and 13, but... Yeah. All right, next up, we have the Investigator. The Investigator is the first townsfolk we were going to look at that does evil detection. The Investigator's ability is you start knowing that one of two players is a particular minion. I think, in my mind, the Investigator is another one of those characters who's very, like, hurt by meta. And specifically, storytellers are too scared of creating conflict with the investigator off the hop, and they too frequently show investigators recluses instead of an actual minion.
I agree with that.
It's quite strong. Investigator is one of the stronger characters out there, and it needs sort of the argument of recluse and drunk to explain bad information for the investigator to keep it balanced, but it's certainly a character that knowing where a minion is super powerful information, and knowing what the minion type in play is also super powerful information.
It's certainly one of the strongest pieces of information you can give good in the early game on Trouble Brewing.
Yeah. You're not obviously, like the Washerman and the Librarian, trying to confirm your player. You're trying to figure out who you want dead, which is a major distinction with those two characters.
And the investigator has a couple of... Sorry, go ahead, Emma. Sorry.
And I think this makes the investigator, in many ways, more powerful than the Washerwoman or Librarian, but less interesting. Because the investigator, I think, is much more one-track. Like, one of the investigator's jobs is to smooth out the Trouble Brewing playing experience by focusing a location for an execution on day one. And I think, you know, Trouble Brewing character games can... It can, like, investigators aren't obligated to out their information and make their accusation decisions day one. But I do think they should think about the drag it can place on a Trouble Brewing game if they choose to play it closer to the chest and not out that information.
I think there's maybe, like, three kind of worth thinking about play patterns for investigator. The first one is, out your information to the town. This puts pressure on a minion and probably an unfortunate townsfolk who's been seen against this minion. Or maybe, you know, a minion and a recluse who has been put in that ping to make it seem like the minion's not a minion. But, like, this gives town something immediately to start working on solving. Even if you don't kill into that right away, like, it gives town something worth solving. Play number two is, if you talk to both of your pings, you don't let them know you're the investigator, and you get a social read on them, and you think, I don't know, neither of these players seems like they're on the evil team, like they both seem above board, go look for a virgin. Nominate a virgin and see what happens, right? Like, that's kind of play pattern two. And then play pattern three is, you know, kind of sit on it for a day, or maybe a day, and kind of see how those players act, see how those players interact, you know, maybe watch how they vote, and you might get some additional information. But honestly, I think the most straightforward play patterns are point at the two players and go, there's a minion there, or nominate a virgin. Like, those are your kind of two most straightforward and useful play patterns. So I would put investigator just a step below Washerwoman and Librarian. I would put it in the B tier.
I would agree with that. Next up is the chef, and the chef is the sort of final of the Trouble Brewing townsfolk that get all their information on night one. So I think after we finish talking with the chef, we should sort of sum up some thoughts about these night ones altogether. The chef's ability is you start knowing how many players of evil players there are.
How many pairs of evil players,
Yeah, and this is, I think, the most common rules question I could ask when running a new player of Trouble Brewing, and that is, what does pairs mean? Because it's not something that makes sense when you read the token and read the ability.
Yep.
A pair is two players sitting next to each other in the grim. So the chef individually checks each set of two players in the grim, going around the circle, and learns how many of those individual pairs are evil. So each player gets checked twice, once with each of their two neighbors, and the chef learns how many of those total pairs are evil. Have two evil players in them.
Yeah, and again, starting from a place of Trouble Brewing, the chef's strategy is largely going to be similar to the kind of strategy we talked about in terms of just, like, trying to look like a more powerful character, maybe getting killed in the night. But quite frankly, like, the chef number is a really strong piece of information for the good team. And so, in general, you're going to just want to get that information out there. There's not a whole lot of, like, ability-related choice you need to make as the chef.
Yeah, I think a lot of what the chef's going to be wanting to do in terms of strategy is sort of keep looking at the Grim holistically in terms of where dead players are in relation to their numbers. There's a few things that you should know as the chef. If you get a zero, it makes it somewhat more likely that your direct neighbors are evil. If you get a one or a two, it makes it somewhat more likely that your direct neighbors are good. These don't have to be true in either case. It just slightly increases the odds, and you should think about that as a chef. And as players die in the night, you should start seeing how this creates or rules out different worlds based on your chef number. And I think that's one of the main reasons the chef might want to hide and hide their number, is if evil doesn't know that they have to kill around a chef number, they might not do it.
Yeah. The chef has to zoom out. We don't really think of the chef as, like, meta information. We think of it as direct information. But it's sort of meta information about the killing pattern that the evil team is taking, or the seeding pattern of the Grim. And when you think about it that way, you know, if you can zoom out and look at the Grim not as a group of roles, but as just those seats and what players are alive next to each other and who's died in the night and who's been executed, sometimes you can just find the evil team by figuring out, oh, I have a chef one. Those two players are still alive together. It's pretty late in the game. Those are probably evil players. I do think that there's some other interactions just to mention that are off of Trouble Brewing. If there's a magician on script, if there's a poppy grower on script, you may want to hide your chef number to some extent, because that will help the evil team find each other. I've used a chef number before. I'm sure Emma's used a chef number before in a magician game or a poppy grower game to help find minions or help find the demon. And so it's worth thinking about, like, what else is on the script when you do give out your chef information. It's generally information that's safe to give out fairly early and can help town. It doesn't help town early is kind of one of the weird things. It's safe to give out early, but, you know, short of finding a recluse and killing their neighbors, there's not a whole lot you can do with it early in the game.
Yeah.
I think it's a C tier.
I was going to say B. I think it's quite similar to Investigator in power level and strategic depth.
Okay. I'm willing to go there for now. We should talk about the top fours for a sec.
Yeah, so the top fours as a whole, makes them different from the other characters on Trouble Brewing, and we'll get to the other characters in a second, is the top fours get all their information in act before poisoners and imps have any chance to get reads on the Grim. This makes your information on a meta level somewhat more reliable than townsfolk that operate later in the game when the evil team has more information to go off of. This doesn't mean you can't get wrong information. Poisoners get lucky, storytellers place drunks in unfortunate places, spies misregister to washerwomen and librarians. But it does, like, you can meta that your information is more likely to be reliable than it is for other characters.
I think it's maybe also worth just saying that there's a perception of ongoing information roles as being sort of the more powerful roles at times. That if you're a starting info role, you get your info, and then you're kind of done. But you're not done. You're a player in the game that's solving the game and has incredibly strong information. Like, the balance of not getting information over and over again is that you got really strong information up front. It can become outdated, right? The imp can star pass, you know, things can happen. But it's worth being aware that your benefit for not going every night is that you know something really important.
Yeah.
And always remember that you know your information. It could be poison, it could be drunk, but you know your information. That's a piece of information that you always have. And when your information is just one thing, sometimes it's easier to solve that out in the late game than trying to solve out, you know, several days of information.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Did you have any other thoughts there, Emma?
No. I think, like, the top fours as bluffs can be quite useful, powerful, because sometimes good players... Sometimes players will meta that demons won't bluff these roles because they're expendable, which is something you can certainly use to your advantage when bluffing them.
Yep, I agree with that too. Love a good top four bluff.
All right, next we're going to move on to the Empath. The Empath is one of the highest win rate characters in the game from what little we know about the Under the Hood statistics, what little has been shared with us. We know that the Empath is extremely powerful in helping the good team win. The Empath's ability is, each night you learn how many of your two alive neighbors are evil. So the two players who are sitting closest to you and who are alive when you learn your information, which is after the demon kills. So this can change based on who gets killed in the night. You learn exactly how many of them are evil. You learn a 0, a 1, or a 2. I think the Empath has a lot of ways it can think about what to do with that information. And a lot of it depends on what information it gets. If the Empath gets a 0, one of the most useful things an Empath can do, I think, is get themselves killed during the day, either by a virgin or so they can be seen by an Undertaker. Because confirming that that information is true, or at least mostly true, is going to be a lot more valuable than getting your good neighbors killed so you can get reads on other players. I think if you have a 1 or a 2, that calculus changes a lot. You have a much higher interest in getting your neighbors killed so you can learn more information and see how your information changes.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with everything Emma said there. I don't really have a whole lot to add. Empath has a lot of different ways it can play, and it gets that constant stream of information on its neighbors, which means you can take any number and do a lot of things with it. You can, like she said, get confirmed with a 0. You can get a 1 and maybe push on your neighbors, or see which of your neighbors lives longer, or see if either of your neighbors dies in the night, right? If you have a 1 on your neighbors and one of your neighbors dies in the night, the other one might just be evil, you know? So you can play it a lot of different ways. You don't just have to push aggressively. You can actually, with an Empath 0, even find one of your neighbors that's willing to nominate a virgin or that's willing to be killed for confirmation and see if you can get more information that way. There's a bunch of different ways you can play Empath, and I do think it's a very strategic townsfolk, especially on TV.
Yeah, I think one thing with the Empath you do have to remember is it's probably more likely than for any other townsfolk that you're the drunk. And that is because storytellers are, again, very scared, or storytellers are rightly worried about Empaths sitting next to demons, especially if Scarlet Woman aren't in play. And then a little less worried about Empath sitting next to Scarlet Woman. So that is something that I think Empaths do have to be very cognizant of, is that on a meta level, they're more likely to be drunk. You shouldn't, I don't think, assume you're drunk, but you should. Another good reason you might want to let yourself get killed for an Undertaker or try to nominate a virgin as an Empath with a good read on your neighbors is you may want to see if this good read exists because you're drunk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's all pretty right. It's certainly A tier. I don't know if it's S tier. I don't know if it's game-changingly complex, you know, deep strategy. I'm not sure. But we have two in A tier, so I'd be willing to kind of push this up to S tier until we see what else happens.
We can put it in A tier, and then I think at the end of the TB we can decide whether we want to move anything to S tier if we don't have anything there.
That sounds good. Fortune Teller, of course, is up next.
Yeah, Fortune Teller is the other main every night recurring info role on TB. The Fortune Teller's ability is, each night choose two players. You learn if either is a demon, there is a good player that registers as a demon to you. So, in addition to that red herring, of course, recluses can register as demons to you, and you can be poisoned. So there's lots of opportunities for fortune tellers to get bad information.
And that recluse possibility is slightly increased because on TB, because Baron is on TB, and so Baron could even add that recluse in. So you're likely going to be dealing with that one piece of misinformation on a recluse. noteworthy to remember that recluse, a player that registers as both a minion and a demon, is probably a recluse. So if you do get a ping on someone that's in an investigator ping or something like that, then you're probably dealing with a recluse there. So that's kind of something you can figure out.
I do think storytellers are too trigger happy with the recluse's ability.
Yeah,
I think like, what I would like to see storytellers do more of is not register the recluse to the fortune teller the first time they're checked, and then maybe register the recluse to the fortune teller on a later night if they're checked again with a different player you want to throw suspicion on.
Yep, I like doing that. I think I've been doing quite a lot more of waiting on that recluse to ping the fortune teller, and to be honest, it often socially ends up getting the recluse killed anyway if you give a no, because the fortune teller, of course, goes, well, why did I get a no on the recluse? So I think there's some stuff there. In terms of your picking strategy, you know, your first night, probably your second night, you're not going to have a lot. But if you're making it to night three or night four as the fortune teller, you want to start thinking about how you can isolate out demon candidates. You want to be using your social reads. You want to try to start combining other players' information into yours. Empaths, chefs, washerwomen. You want to try to be picking out of confirmation groups. You want to use the information that's there to try to inform your selections.
Yeah, I think also fortune tellers getting no's is more useful than fortune tellers getting yes's, and I think that can be sort of counterintuitive for fortune tellers. Ruling out demon candidates is generally going to be more efficient than finding demon candidates, because when you get a no, you've cleared two players, whereas when you get a yes, you've identified that one of two players is either the demon or your red herring, which is less useful than learning two of them are not the demon. I think fortune tellers benefit a lot from hiding if they want to maximize the power of their information, in the sense that like fortune tellers who don't hide are like prime murder and poison targets for evil. So fortune tellers do have to think a lot about how to balance like how much they want to be trusted by town, i.e., which is generally accomplished by telling the truth, versus how powerful they want their information to be, which for the fortune teller in particular is generally going to be inversely proportional to how much you lie, or directly proportional to how much you lie. The more you lie as a fortune teller, the better your information will be, but the less likely you'll be trusted by town.
And fortune tellers are often framed. They make great frames, especially if their information has been disrupted by drunkenness, a red herring. They've gotten a bunch of players killed. Even if it's just one night of poisoning got two good players killed, those two good players are going to be looking at that fortune teller going, I'm not really sure about this. That seems questionable. So as an evil player, if you're bluffing fortune teller, you obviously want to not point at your demon. If you're the demon bluffing fortune teller, you're probably going to look pretty suspicious in final three. It's a better minion bluff than demon bluff, of course.
Yeah. I think because the fortune teller's information... I don't know. What do you think fortune teller goes, Milk?
This is the first one, genuinely. I'm having a really hard time figuring out where it goes. The information is... And I think part of the problem is I'm having a hard time distinguishing the strength of fortune teller against the strategy. There are choices that the fortune teller is making about who they're picking. And how they sort of play socially and how they reveal themselves. But fundamentally, if you find yeses, you kill them. If you find no's, you don't. Like, that's fortune teller in a nutshell in terms of the ability itself.
Yeah, the ability is pushing you on a very particular track, I think. My inclination is it goes in B tier.
I think that's right. It's very strong, but I think strategically it's get a yes, push on your yes, get a yes, push on your yes. If you find someone you think they're not the demon, then maybe they're a red herring and you can maybe not push on them. And maybe when do you sort of out your information to town more broadly? Yeah. I think B's fine.
Next up we have, of course, the Undertaker. This is our final recurring information role on Trouble Brewing. This is each night each night, asterisk, you learn which character died by execution today. Something that's important to remember with the Undertaker is this ability is, in a lot of social deduction games, just part of the baseline rules of the game. Whenever a player is eliminated, everyone learns their character.
Yep.
Blood on the Clock Tower takes that away and gives it uniquely to the Undertaker. And only for executions that happen in the day, not kills that happen at night.
Yeah, and, you know, Undertaker has some strategic choices to make in terms of how they push on, you know, finding, getting social reads and trying to push on people who they think will give them valuable information. There's some...
Mostly you just want to execute someone every day.
Yeah, I mean, there's basically just, like, always vote. Like, you're always voting on everybody. Always, like, unless you really think they're, like, don't vote on the virgin that already, you know, killed someone. Don't vote on, like, a washerwoman confirmed player, maybe. But, like, you want to be killing somebody.
You just want to encourage executions, which is what all good players generally want to do. You gain powerful information off executions, but one of the reasons the Undertaker exists is to make sure players is to help players learn that executing is just good for the good team. So I think in this sense, I don't have a lot to say about the strategic depth of an Undertaker. I think it's pretty low on the strategic depth because it's just sort of very run track. Try to find the most suspicious person and execute them, then go to the second most suspicious, then the third, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, it's I think it's probably C tier, pretty much straight up.
Yeah. It can be a very powerful bluff, though, because it's a confirmatory role. Like, especially if you don't have a spell, you're just good at Grim Reading, it's a really good bluff.
Yeah, that's actually very fun to bluff, by the way. If you ever get a chance to do it and you do get a little bit of experience at Grim Reading, just try it sometime. Try just bluffing Undertaker and just cold calling roles. I've gotten through games where I undertook people whose roles were outed, bluffing... You know, bluffing as an Undertaker, everybody who got killed, their role was at it. So I was like, yeah, they are what they say they are. And then eventually I framed somebody, I think, or showed somebody as a drunk or something. But yeah, there's some fun you can have with it.
All right. Next up, we have the Monk. The Monk's ability is... Oops, I thought I clicked on the Monk page. Sorry. Oh, I did. I just opened it a new tab. Now I have two tabs of it open. All right, Monk. Each night, choose a player, not yourself. They are safe from the demon tonight. Safe is an undefined keyword in Blood on the Clock Tower that, despite many requests, the Pandemonium Institute steadfastly refuses to clarify what they intend for that word to mean. So we don't need to worry about that word too much. For the sake of Trouble Brewing, we can tell you that safe means if the imp attacks a player who you've protected, that player will not die, even though they otherwise should.
That's correct. So
I'm gonna just set out my argument that the Monk is our first S tier townsfolk.
Oh yeah, 100%.
The Monk has the Monk gains a ton of benefit from being able to accurately predict who the demon wants to kill, and on top of that, from once it's predicted the demon's kill pattern, deciding when it wants to reveal itself by protecting the player the demon is going to kill. And I think as a monk, the most powerful thing, bar none, I've seen monks do is to be so suspicious enough that the demon won't kill them. And not get any protections off until there's four players alive, at which point the monk successfully identifies which of the other two players the demon is going to kill, and the monk stops them. At that point, the demon is in a brutal bind of either needing to kill the monk who they've been framing because the monk is being suspicious, or bring the player they really, really don't want to be alive into Final Three because there's an annoying monk in their way. So I think, the monk needs to keep both these aspects in mind. It's, one, being able to figure out who on the grim the demon is most likely to kill every night, which is not always the player who you think you should be protecting. It's not even always the virgin, because the demon is probably going to expect the virgin to be monk-protected, and go somewhere else. It's certainly not fortune tellers and empaths all the time. If you could find, like, the washerwoman confirmed player and sneak a little protection on them, a librarian confirmed outsider and sneak a protection on them, that can be really strong. So there's that aspect of it. And then at what stage of the game do you want to pull the trigger on hopefully getting your accurate prediction correct and blocking the demon kill? Like, I think a lot of times when I'm playing Monk, I'll do things like protect the Virgin for a while until I'm ready to try to play the game of block the kill with the demon. And if the demon attacks the Virgin while I'm doing it, no harm, no foul. I've saved the Virgin another day and made myself look good. And if the demon doesn't, and if I, but if I play my cards right and pivot to not the Virgin on the right night, I can get a lot of mileage out of that.
I think it's important to mention that demons are probably not going to kill virgins at the first opportunity. Virgins
depends on the demon.
Depends, but much of the time, the demon isn't necessarily going to prioritize. You know, let me say it a different way. If the Virgin activates their ability on night one, it is likely that the demon will be looking for fortune tellers, empaths, you know, other roles, rather than just killing the Virgin. Sometimes they'll just kill the Virgin. That's okay.
Kill the Virgin first, demons. It's much more useful to get the Virgin out of the way than it is to get someone you could frame out of the way.
I'm saying something which I have observed in games, and may or may not be useful for people who have the Monk token to be aware of. You may be able to put protections elsewhere. It's not a guarantee. The demon might just kill the Virgin, and then you're going to look like you're not. Then you're going to look evil because you didn't protect the Virgin. But another thing I've experimented with is trying to use revealing that you are the Monk to bait a kill away from other players who are confirmed. Sometimes demons will overreact to someone being the Monk because of the fear that they're going to protect someone. And so something else you can do is if you think there's a like one or two players who you think are good and you don't want them to get killed, you can out that you're the Monk, say publicly who you're going to protect, and force the demon to kill you instead of one of those players, spending one of their night kills. So there's some other things there's some other ways you can play around with the Monk's, the sort of intimidation factor of the Monk being such a powerful townsfolk. I do 100% agree with Emma that the Monk is an S-tier townsfolk.
Yeah. All right, next up we have the Raven Keeper. There's no S in this character's name. Though don't worry, it's not your fault. It's a just a natural function of linguistics that you sometimes add an S there by mistake.
Raven
Keeper. If you die at night, you are woken to choose a player. You learn their character.
Yeah.
Simple, one-time information. Pretty strong if it happens.
And the characters that function in this way, where if they die at night, they learn a piece of information, are often referred to as demon-bane characters. They are characters that the demon generally wants to try to avoid killing, not to activate their ability. Of course, Emma and I have expressed opinions on that in the past as well, so I'll leave it there. But yeah, the Raven Keeper's job is to look like something that the demon wants to kill. In the early game, this usually means a powerful role, for whatever you define as powerful. In the mid to late game, it usually means a socially good, trusted player. And that means that there are other alternatives to playing Raven Keeper than claiming to be the empath, fortune teller, undertaker, what have you. You can just tell the truth and build social trust by saying, I am the Raven Keeper, and I'd like to develop social trust so that the demon is forced to kill me.
Yeah. Generally, as a Raven Keeper, like, the later in the game you can get yourself killed, the better. Because the power of the confirmation of the player you learn, or learning that they're the demon, is stronger the later in the game that is. You can think about this sort of mathematically. If you confirm a good player on night two, that's plenty of time for the demon to deal with the confirmed player. If you of a 12 player game, if you confirm a player on final four when you're killed of the night, you've just eliminated one of the two people the demon had a chance of framing, and you're left with two and the only two demon candidates. And if you're just trying to get the demon, you have a 1-in-3 shot on final four and a 1-in-10 shot if you're killed on a night that starts with 11 players alive.
Yeah, so...
So it is to your benefit to put yourself in a situation where the demon has to kill you later in the game.
Agree with you. And I do think there's some... I do think there's a lot of social play strategically that's driven by that Ravenkeeper ability of what you're bluffing, how you're bluffing it, how you're communicating with other players. It's a role that, while the mechanics of the ability are die in the night, pick a player, learn a thing, I think that set of mechanics actually drives a substantially deep social strategy that you kind of have to chase around during the game. Where do you think this one goes, Emma?
I would say A or S. I think it's up there as one of the more deeper strategy characters on Trouble Brewing.
Yeah.
How you want to bluff, how you want to trick the demon revolves a lot around the meta of your group, which is something you have to pay attention to.
I'll say one other thing, which is that we mentioned that the Undertaker's ability is... something that's information that you would just get, everybody would just get in another social deduction game. For me, although we often say that the drunk is the most, like, Blood on the Clock Tower character, for me, Ravenkeeper represents the thing about Blood on the Clock Tower that makes it a more interesting, engaging, and, from my perspective, fun social deduction game than many of the others, which is that it is the exemplar of... dead players still participate in the game.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's a character that encourages you to get deaded, but to get deaded in a very specific way. I think that's what elevates it to S tier for me, which is where I'm going to put it.
Yeah. Next up, we have the Virgin. The Virgin's ability is... the first time you are nominated, if the nominator is a townsfolk, they are executed immediately. The Virgin is incredibly strong. It is a super strong role. A public confirmation that two players are good townsfolk is wild. It massively reduces the evil's bluffing space. And the only way the evil team can fake this is by sacrificing an evil team member that has to be the spy. The spy is the only way that the evil team can fake this and nominating the Virgin. I don't think the Virgin has much legitimate strategic depth, I'll say. I know plenty of people who have fun with the Virgin by trying to hide it until later in the game, who want to play Hidden Virgin, who want to see if they can make it to Final Three without being nominated. I think this is all in good fun. Virgin executions aren't particularly useful after day one, because after day one, you really want to be focusing on killing evils. They're downright counterproductive on final three. They literally lose good the game. I'm not saying that you can't do these things. These things can be quite fun and funny, and being fun and funny is part of Blood on the Clock Tower. But for the purposes of thinking about the Virgin for this tier list, I don't think we should give them those options legitimate consideration, because... they are directly less helpful for your team than just having someone nominate you day one and see what happens.
Yep, I agree with that 100%. Your Virgin strategy, if you want the strategy of Virgin, the strategy is find a good player to nominate you, get nominated, kill that player, confirm them and you and their information. Then get
and
killed
do this
by
on
the
first day.
Yeah, do this on the first day and then get killed by the demon. Sometime later in the game.
Ideally, you don't ever get killed by the demon.
Sure. I mean, your strategy is don't get killed by the demon, but you're probably going to die.
You have
no
very little options of that. That's up to the demon and the monk, basically, is to decide whether you're going to get killed by the demon or not. Because the demon is not going to want you in the end game.
Is Virgin D tier strategically?
I think so.
Yeah.
It's a really fun character.
It has one play pattern.
It has one strategically legitimate play pattern.
Yeah. It has plenty of fun things you can do with it. Love the Virgin. There's going to be plenty of people who are mad at us for putting it in D tier, but strategically speaking, do the thing. Kill a townsfolk.
Next up is the Slayer. The Slayer is yet another townsfolk. Once per game during the day, publicly choose a player. If they are the demon, they die.
What a great ability.
You know, the Slayer has a bunch of things that are going to come up as we talk about other scripts later. It's a once per game ability, which means the Slayer is an inherent game of chicken. The longer the Slayer waits to use their ability, the more powerful it is, because they have less they have a higher chance of hitting the demon. And even if they miss, like, confirming again, if you shoot on three players alive as a Slayer, confirming that one player isn't the demon means that you've confirmed the other player is the demon. If you shoot on 12 players alive, missing means that there's still 10 players who, from your perspective, can be the demon. So I think a lot of the strategic interest of the Slayer, beyond their just doing all the things all good players should be doing to do of socially reading the game, gathering other people's information, trying to collate it all together to find the player they think is most likely the demon, is the Slayer should try to figure out the balance between when they want to use their ability, between its highest powers on final three, it's least likely to be murdered or poisoned on 12 alive.
Yep. And there's some space in between there. There's some space in the middle where the risk of getting killed by the demon or poisoned, it balances out with your odds of getting the demon with your shot, and you have to find that niche. You have to find that moment. And I think that that's quite an interesting byplay. In addition to layering on top of that, all of the social reading you have to do, all you have to watch, you know, who's voting for whom, who's, you know, voting with who, you know, how are the various different players kind of interacting in terms of their voting. I think there's just a lot in what the Slayer's kind of doing, even though their action is just once per game.
Yeah, I think something else the Slayer can think about doing is if they think someone's good and a lot of other people are pushing on that player, the Slayer can use their shot to prove the point rather than try to find the demon. And sometimes that can be more useful and also more healthy for the game. Like, if a player you, the Slayer, think is good is being pushed on by other good players, like, that can frequently not be fun. And you can use your ability, if you don't have a good sense on who the demon is, but you think town is just wrong about this player being the demon, like, shooting them can have the double effect of, like, making their game more fun while still providing useful information. So I think it's something Slayers should consider more often.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. Slayer's certainly A tier.
Yeah, I think Slayer A or B tier is where I was going to say, so I'm happy to slot it in A.
I think it is A tier. I think the amount of information you have to be aware of, and even to an extent, like, knowing when you're the person that is most okay for the town to kill for an Undertaker, you know, taking a shot and then getting killed for the Undertaker, or getting put on the block and then taking your shot, like, that's all okay too, like, socially and just in terms of, like, again, a healthy play space where you're willing, you know, you're kind of in a space where you're willing to take your shot and die to maybe confirm that you are the Slayer and not the drunk, and confirm that other player. I just think that there's a lot in it.
Next up is the Soldier. The Soldier's ability is you are safe from the demon. Once again, there's that undefined keyword safe, For purposes of Trouble Brewing, it just means the demon can't kill you. On other scripts, it may mean something else. The soldier is much like the Raven Keeper. It's very much a demon bane. It's something the demon... You want the bait the demon into killing you, and they're going to fail. The soldier... A sober soldier will always be in Final Three if they're not executed, which is really powerful.
But that does put you in a little bit of a quandary, because you do need to be socially trusted by town when you get into Final Three. It's one of those characters that you often hear people say, rightly or wrongly, oh, this is a good demon bluff.
Yeah.
I mean, everything's a pretty good demon bluff. And second of all, like, soldiers can just make it to Final Three. They often will, right? Because unless there's a poisoner to deal with them, the evil team's going to have to try to get them executed, and they may not make that social push to get that player executed.
Yeah. When we were talking about the fortune teller, we talked about how the fortune teller exists on that spectrum of the more honest you are, the more town will trust you, and the less likely they will be to execute you, but the more likely the evil team will mess with your information or kill you. Soldier is like that to the 10th degree, because it's not getting information. As a soldier, you have two forks in the road. It doesn't really matter which one you take, but these are the forks you want to be on. One is just be incredibly honest, open, truthful, rely on your ability being you make it to Final Three, make sure Talon doesn't kill you because you're so honest and trustworthy. Road two is to tell a lot of lies, is to try to find that zone that will get lie enough to get the demon to kill you, and knowing that it's going to risk Talon killing you as well.
I actually think that second line of play is the more common one. People look at Soldier and think, oh, I can try to draw a kill, I can try to cover for a empath or a fortune teller. But I think it's more convoluted than the simpler path of just trying to be trusted. And it often means you have to spread bad information, which then can confuse the town. And it usually results in the soldier getting killed because... Or worth a player with the role that they're claiming getting killed.
It's definitely more convoluted. It's frequently more fun, which is why people choose it.
Sure.
Than just doing, like, the straightforward, honest, on the shield that will protect town to Final Three. Play. I think the fortune teller, the soldier, is very limited to choosing which one of those paths and it wants to do pretty early and sticking to it. Mm-hmm. Which is why I think I wanted in B or C tier.
Yeah, I'm inclined to put it in C tier. I do think it's much more limited than anything that's in B tier in terms of its strategic options.
All right. And then we're going to round out Trouble Brewing with our final Trouble Brewing townsfolk, the mayor. This is the mayor's ability. If only three players live and no execution occurs, your team wins. If you die at night, another player might die instead. I also want to read from something else in the almanac, which we don't always do in this tier list, but I think is very important for thinking about the mayor. We recommend you keep the mayor alive until the final day, since it is most fun for the players that way. On rare occasions, if the group is overwhelmingly convinced early in the game that the mayor is the mayor, let the mayor die so that evil has a chance to win.
Yep, that sounds
much more important than the text on the mayor's ability is this two sentence description of when the mayor should be, when the might on the mayor's ability should function. Basically, the more town is convinced you are the mayor, the more the storyteller should let you die in the night. If the game's inevitably going to end in a mayor win, unless the demon can kill you in the night, you are much more likely to die, and in fact, the storyteller frequently should kill you in that situation, so it's fun and fair to evil.
Yep.
And therein lies the rub of the mare. The thing you have to do to guarantee yourself a path to Final Three is to not have the town convinced you're the mare. The thing you need to do to win in Final Three is convince town you're the mare.
And now that's going to drive a whole strategy for the character, if we think about it in this way, right? Because it means you need to be suspicious up to a certain point and then start gaining trust. So unlike Ravenkeeper or Soldier, where you can just sort of try to be trusted for the entire game, the mayor doesn't want that arc. The mayor wants to start being trusted close to the end of the game so that they can hopefully live throughout the early part of the game and then get to be in Final Three and get to potentially get that mayor win.
Yeah. If you go around telling everyone you're the mayor, getting Ravenkeepers to check you, getting Slayers to shoot you, trying to get yourself next to an empath, and getting Fortune Tellers to check you, that makes it much more likely that the demon is going to be able to kill you. The demon doesn't get to kill you by picking you a lot of times. The demon gets to kill you basically based on how full your trust quotient is.
Yep. The more you're trusted, the more likely it is that you'll die instead of someone else when you're targeted. It's really very simple conceptually, but it means that the mayor has this really challenging social play. Again, much like the Ravenkeeper in a sense, but with the addition of now having to survive being suspicious for a couple of days and then survive being trusted. So you have to survive the good team while being suspicious for the first half of the game, and then you have to survive the evil team while being trusted. Yeah, in the back half of the game. And that's hard.
Yeah. It is sort of one track, but I think it's a very interesting track. And the mayor is always allowed to go off the track and just be honest and see what happens. That's a choice the mayor always can make.
They may get killed, and you know that might be something that happens. But if you're going to get executed, you may as well at least get that information out there.
And I'm of two minds. I think the mayor the choice the mayor has to make of how to balance its sort of survivability versus trust is one of the most tricky and nuanced choices, not just in Trouble Room, but in all of Blood on the Clock Tower.
Yeah.
But it is very one track.
It makes me think a lot of Fortune Teller, to be honest. I think the things we've said about Mayor are very similar to the things we've said about Fortune Teller. There's a little bit of Ravenkeeper in there, but there's also a little bit of Soldier in there, which makes me think it naturally fits into B tier. But I could be convinced to put it in A tier.
My inclination is A tier. I think, like, the subtlety of the process for the mayor is so important. I think we have to put an A tier, even if it's got a little bit those elements of Fortune Teller and Soldier we dragged down a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely one of my favorite. It's definitely one of my favorite townsfolk, and I always find the strategy of playing it challenging, and so I think that leads me to agree with you. This is an interesting curve. We're a little further up, but I think I expected the Trouble Brewing townsfolk to be more strategically robust than average.
I would agree with that.
It's an incredibly strategic script. Even though it's the most approachable and most balanced script, those may be things that make it more strategic. But I think each of these characters has a lot of depth. Even Soldier and Undertaker, which we kind of placed a little bit lower, but there is strategic depth to those characters. Virgin is very one track, but it's nice to see that 10 of the 13 Trouble Brewing townsfolk fit in the top three tiers here.
I agree.
All right. Yeah. I don't think I want to shift any of these around.
No, I think I'm pretty happy with this. We may have a week off here because of holiday stuff. So there may be a week where we don't have an episode. It might be after this one. It might be after the next one. But there will probably be a week where we briefly drop off the air before we get back on our regular schedule.
Yep. I'm going to be at PAX Unplugged for anybody who's going to be there from December 5th through the 9th. So feel free if you see me. I'll be in the social deduction area. I'm hanging around playing board games with people. So if you see me, come by and say hi. But that'll be the week that I probably won't be doing podcast editing. So that'll be the week we lose an episode somehow.
Mm-hmm.
We should remind everybody about the giveaway. We're getting right up to the end here now. About a week left in the giveaway from when this episode will come out. So again, if you do want to get a badge to Final 3 Con, send us an email to grimscenariospodcast@gmail.com telling us a story about a time when someone was kind to you in Blood on the Clock Tower.
All right. May your scenarios stay grim. We'll see you soon, friends.
Bye, everybody.